Morning. Can you hear me on this? Okay. Hello, and welcome to Being a Long-Timer panel discussion. My name is Susan. I'm a compulsive overeater. Hi, everybody. While the topic of this panel is being a long-timer, and the speakers all have experience in this particular area, this panel is open to everyone. We will introduce ourselves and qualify and speak for 20 minutes on the topic of what it is like to work an OA program for as long as each of us have worked our program. Is there somebody in the audience today who would be willing to time this panel discussion today? Anybody willing? Great, thank you. Please give each speaker a 10-minute warning, and then a 5-minute warning, and finally a 2-minute warning for 20 minutes. Thank you. Today, our first speaker is Randy.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Randy, and I am a compulsive overeater. I want to start off my share with a little bit of a story. Friday night, when the chair, I think it was Michelle, asked for a raise of hands on who had 40 or more years of abstinence, I wanted so badly to put my hand up, because I will be 40 in 6 weeks. But there was this, you know, like Jiminy Cricket, the angel and the devil on each shoulder. And the devil said, come on, it's only 6 weeks. What can happen between now and then? But the angel said, this is a program of rigorous honesty. And who knows what might happen in 6 weeks. So I put my hand down because my program has taught me that this is a program of rigorous honesty. And if I'm dishonest with myself, who knows what else I would be dishonest about. I came into this program on March 4th of 1976. I was 23 years old. So for those of you who are young'uns, this is what abstinence looks like in 40 years. You get gray. You get saggy. You have to eat less to maintain your weight and exercise more. And it sucks, and I don't like it. But you know something? When I waddled into my first OA meeting, I don't know what my top weight was, but I do know it was well in excess of 200 pounds. And I'm only 5'2", or I was 5'2" at the time. Now I'm 5'0½". One of the other lovely things about getting older. But when I walked into my first OA meeting, they had all of these slogans on these huge posters at the top of the church. And one of those is that abstinence is the most important thing in your life without exception. I believed it then. I believe it now. I believe it every single day. And I think that's a good part of why I'm still around 39 years and 10 months later. Because I remember my last binge like it was yesterday. And I never want to forget that. That's what keeps me coming back. A little bit of background. I grew up, you know, your typical professional, middle-class Jewish family in Philadelphia. And I jokingly said that my parents were both doctors. So in the 1950s, 1960s, the idea is that you should grow up and marry a doctor. But my parents, both being doctors, also wanted me to go into the family business. So I got a double whammy. My parents wanted me to be a doctor and marry a doctor. And that was the level of perfectionism that I just could not live up to. And I jokingly say I'm a recovering compulsive overeater, but I'm also a recovering perfectionist, and I am a recovering drama queen. I did not realize I was a drama queen until I had been abstinent a couple of years, though. It's really funny how, for me, and this is my opinion only, the absence of food or the absence of excess food made me realize all the reasons that I compulsively overate. I had to have my mind cleared of the fog of the excess food before I could deal on the emotions and the underlying reasons. I walked into my first meeting. I was afraid to look you in the eye. I couldn't hold a one-on-one conversation with another human being without two different reactions. Reaction number one was, oh my God, I'm so scared of you. I don't know what to say to you. The other part was that I was busy analyzing you to see what were your likes and dislikes. What did you want me to say? I would drive myself crazy because I would be so focused on what I thought you wanted to hear and to parrot back. But somehow I knew when I walked into my first OA meeting, I knew in my gut, in my heart, with every fiber, that this was the answer to me. I remember back when I was 11 or 12 years old, like 6th or 7th grade, I did a report for my health class on alcoholism and drug addiction. And I remember saying to my mom, I'm just like an alcoholic with food. I didn't realize it at the time, but I instinctively knew what it was. And my mom gave me the trifecta, which is, oh, Randy, you're too sensitive, you're imagining things, and you're wrong. What's so hilarious is that I just spent a week and a half on the East Coast, and we were talking about something. And my mother, 65 years later, said the exact same thing. She does not, God love her, have a program. I do. The program has given me the strength to say, well, Mom, I see it a little bit differently. And that was the end of the matter. I walked into my first meeting full of fear. I didn't realize it at the time, but full of anger. All I knew was that I could not stop eating. It wasn't even about the weight anymore for me. It was that I was powerless over food. So when Overeaters Anonymous held out their hand to me and said, this is what you've got to do, I was beaten down enough so that I said, okay, I will do it. And being the fearful person, insecure person that I was, I thought that the leader had some magic power. So I walked up to the leader afterwards and asked if she would sponsor me. She said, you're going to follow directions. This is what you're going to do. You are going to follow a food plan. And she said, quite frankly, I don't care what it is, but it's something that you need to feel that you can live with comfortably for the rest of your life, one day at a time, without binging. And I was so broken down, and I said, okay, fine. And she said, you will call me every single day at such and such a time. And she was a news reporter for a local radio station, so her time was very, very limited. I had to call her exactly after her 10 a.m. newscast so that we could talk. And then she could prepare for her 11 o'clock newscast. And I did that. She said, you will write for 20 minutes a day. And I was so broken down that I did that. She said, you will call at least one person every day aside from me. And I was so broken down that I did that. Fast forward about a year. I had lost the weight. I was thin. I was 24. I was, all of a sudden I realized that I was attractive. And years 2 through 5 were probably the most miserable I'd ever had personally. Because all of a sudden, without the crutch of the food, I realized that I knew I was fearful, but I didn't know how angry I was. And I, through the years, I realized that all of this anger, all of this fear, all of this whatever, all boiled down to 1 3-letter word, and that's ego. Fear to me is I'm afraid that I'm not going to get something that I think I deserved. That's ego. Fear is what happens if I get it. Also, I learned that I was as fearful of success as I was of failure. And what all of that ego boiled down to is steps 2 and 3. And for me, that is the watchword of my entire program, is steps 2 and 3. And a lot of time when I realize that I'm not taking step 3, I have to go back and realize that what's really happening is that I'm not taking step 2. And I'm not taking step 2 because I'm not taking step 1. With food, thank God, I've been placed in that position of neutrality. I remember I had chaired this birthday party event back in 2002. And someone for another event had walked by with this huge tray of desserts. And a couple of people commented to me, oh my God, did you see those desserts? You know, I hadn't even seen them. And that's what daily practice of this program has allowed me to do. Is that I could just not even see the desserts. It may have well have been a pitcher of water or a doorknob. Why do I keep coming back almost 40 years later? Because I have no doubt in my mind whatsoever that if I did not follow the practice of this program on a daily basis, that I would be out there again. I've seen too many people, even people with long-term abstinence, and if this scares you, yes, it should. I've seen too many people go out and come back in again a couple of years later. A specific example is when I first moved to California. I started out in the program in Cleveland and moved to L.A. when I was about a year and a half abstinent. And I had this very dear friend who now weighs 350 pounds. And they've been in and out and in and out. And every time they come back in, they're 50, 100 pounds heavier. I don't want to be that person. I've gone to funerals of people who one person lost about 400 pounds and gained about 250 of it back. I went to his funeral. I don't want that to be me. Longevity is very common in my family. My parents, God bless them, are 90 and healthy as horses. Neither of them are compulsive overeaters. And I want to be them. And I know that in order to be like them, I have to do the work. This year, I'm devoting myself to self-discipline. That's something that we kind of forget as a long-timer, that I forget as a long-timer. I'm becoming very, very aware of how many times the word self-discipline appears in the OA and the AA literature. It's like, wow, I never saw that before. So I'm doing the same stuff that I did in the beginning. I'm writing down my food. I have a food accountability group of about 7 or 8 people, and we email each other our food every single day. I call my sponsor at 7:30 a.m. every single day, except Saturday because I have a meeting at that time. I maintain my contact with the OA community here in Los Angeles. I moved to Tucson, Arizona about 1.5 years ago. It was very much of a decision that, it was very much of a God shot. When I turned things over to my higher power, amazing things happen. My significant other and I went to Tucson for a scouting trip. That was on a Saturday. On that next Tuesday, we were in escrow on a house. We just loved the community. We found the perfect house. And it was very much of a knowledge in my inner being that my higher power, this is a move my higher power wanted to make. Tucson is not perfect. I miss program terribly. You guys from Los Angeles, appreciate what you have because you have something incredibly special. I want to close with a little story. For 30 years, I gave lip service to the concept of a higher power. I said, and it was a struggle for me to internalize that whole higher power thing. I grew up in an agnostic family, observant but agnostic. So higher power was a little tough. About 10 years ago, I was having some job issues. It was very apparent I was in the wrong job, and I knew I was going to get my butt canned. I decided to write a resume, but not for the job that you wanted me to have. I wrote a resume for the job that I really wanted. I worked with an expert, and we crafted a resume. I also wrote a list of the 20 companies that I really, really wanted to work for. The day after I wrote that, I get a call from a very dear friend. He said, I just wanted to let you know that I'm changing jobs. I'm now working for ABC Corporation, by the way, which happened to be number 2 on my list. They happen to have an opening for this position in Los Angeles. And he said, it's the dream job that you and I have talked about for 15 years. God told me that you would be interested. Are you? I said, you'll have my resume in 5 minutes. He said, don't you want to take a look at the job description? I said, fine, send me the job description. I took a look at the job description. I took a look at my resume. I didn't have to change a damn thing. And this is the job 10 years later I'm still at. And I had no doubt after that there was a higher power at work in my life. I've had a lot of ups and downs. I've had a lot of really serious trauma. I'm not going to go into that here because it's another program, but I have no doubt that this program works. Thank you for letting me share.
Hi, I'm Susan. I'm a compulsive overeater. Hi, thanks, Randy. That was great. Thank you. I got abstinent on October 26, 1986. And this year, for the first time when I celebrated my birthday, I thought, wow, I've been doing this a long time, you know? Not half my life yet. I'm waiting to do this more than half my life, but that's not for a few years. My first conscious memory of being obsessed with food happened when I was four. And by the time I was six, I was being made fun of for my size. When I was 10, I was put on my first diet. Also around that time, I remember that my brother had a bar mitzvah, and on the food table there was so much food that I loved, I couldn't get enough. I had no ability to stop eating, and I kind of ate myself sick. I just remember kind of lying down, not being able to move because I had so much food in me. I fixed that about 15 years later when I became bulimic. So I knew how to get rid of that food that I couldn't stand up. But I remember eating so much being bulimic that I couldn't even stand up straight as I was going to purge. And being bulimic lasted about 10 years. And then I just went back to plain old compulsive overeating. I came in here. I was a size 18, not even 5'2". So I've lost about 50 pounds here. I love Overeaters Anonymous, and I feel so happy to be able to talk about that love that I have for it today to you, because certainly there's been nothing in my life as significant as this, and the biggest gift I ever got in my life. When Randy talked about abstinence is the most important thing, my abstinence is, if I'm not abstinent, I have nothing. I don't have my family. I don't have the relationships that I have cultivated over the years, honest relationships, talking about feelings, things like that. And I don't compulsively eat today. My abstinence is very black and white. It's very defined, so I know when I am. I know when I'm not. I also have a food plan that's also defined. It's more, my food plan is more about behaviors, and that's how I've been living this life. I came in, I didn't get abstinent right away. I came in about in May. I got abstinent in October, as I said. I came in May. I remember it was Memorial Day weekend, and, you know, just kind of just worn and just totally defeated. I couldn't stay on a diet past 10 o'clock in the morning. Every day I woke up, what diet am I going to be on today? Since I was 10 and put on that first diet, that was my first thought early in the morning. And I couldn't do it past 10 o'clock. And so I came in, and that first meeting, somebody spoke. She only lost 10 pounds. She was normal weight. She didn't really have full-on weight problem. But yet I related to her. She talked about having a disease. And that was a great relief for me to hear that, number one, I had a disease, meaning it wasn't my fault. You know, I never blamed myself for having pneumonia when I was 10 years old. But as an adult now, there was something that I could do about it. So I remember after that first meeting, somebody said to me, "Are you coming tomorrow? There's another meeting here." It was like, coming tomorrow? I'm here today. What am I coming tomorrow? But I was such a people pleaser, so I went the next day. And I didn't understand any of it, you know. Like Randy talked about that first speaker she thought was like, you know, the head of OA. I did too. And I always, and I wondered, why are they reading from something? Don't they know this by now? You know, anyway, I came and I stayed. I'm not exactly sure why I stayed, except that in hindsight, I saw people who were comfortable in their own skin. And I never felt like that without something in my body to make me feel that way, be it food or some kind of chemical. And I wanted that. I wanted to know how they got it. And people were generally kind of a happy group, you know. I didn't want anybody to hug me. I didn't need any friends or whatever. But I just wanted the diet. That's really all that I wanted. People would talk about the Big Book. And somebody was looking at was reading something from the Big Book one day, and I saw these columns in the Big Book, and I thought, that must be the diet. Never, ever occurring to me that the book is called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're not talking about a diet in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I bought the book. I went through it, and all I saw were columns of, I'm mad at Mr. Brown because he's flirted with my wife, all that. That's not it. I couldn't find the diet, of course. And I kept looking for it for a while. So I kept going. I heard things here I never heard of before, the way people thought of things, the way people behaved. I came from a place that I thought my parents were God, really. I thought that their opinions were correct, and if you didn't believe in their opinions, you were wrong. That's kind of it, you know. You were wrong, and you got into trouble. And a big turning point for me was I was at a meeting early on, and I was online to thank the speaker. And the woman before me came up to the speaker, and she said, you know, this was a Big Book meeting. She said, you know, I'm a writer, and this book is very poorly written. And I got scared. I got scared. I thought, oh, she's going to get really yelled at. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen. And the speaker said to her, you know, that's very kind. We're not in charge of that. She turned open the Big Book. She said, if you write to, you know, General Services, you know, tell them what you just told me and let them, you know, and give them that offer. I thought that was the most amazing thing that I ever heard of in my life. I really did. And I thought, this is safe. I don't even know if I consciously thought that, but I felt safe here. I felt really safe. I got a sponsor pretty early on. I had to get fixed up with a sponsor, and nobody would sponsor me who I asked. And so I knew somebody, this guy I knew in AA. He said, oh, I know somebody who wants to sponsor in OA. So I called her. And like Randy, I called her every morning. And at first, I didn't even know what to say. What do I say to somebody? She's a total stranger. But I remember I have my papers that, because she always gave me writing every day. And I have my papers from that time. And I remember calling her up one day, and I felt insane. And I felt totally incapacitated. My head was spinning. I wasn't sure what was going on, and I said to her, I don't know what to do. And I have it posted. It says, take a shower, wash your hair, get dressed, call Paula back. I mean, I really had to be led by the hand in how to live a life. And that's what I did. I really was angry about the God thing. I didn't want to believe in a God, and that's actually what kept me from coming for a while, because I knew the Serenity Prayer. I knew the first word of the Serenity Prayer was God. And but I came. I was one of those people who read in the Big Book where it said these steps are a suggested program of recovery. I read it to mean these steps are suggestions. Take what you want. Leave the rest. So I thought, okay, I can do that. So any step that had the word God or capital H for he in it, I crossed out in my mind. I had two steps left. I had the first step, and I had the 12th step. So I thought, okay, I know I'm a compulsive overeater, step one, and step 12, and I'm happy to talk about it to anybody who wants to hear. That was my program. So I kept coming back. I kept coming back. I took notes at meeting. I see somebody here with a pad. Thank you. I see someone here with a pad. I took little notes. I have them all compiled in little notebooks at home. I still have them. I still have a pad in my purse ready to take notes. And what I noticed is that anybody who had what I wanted, who felt at ease with themselves, who felt comfortable with themselves, the one thing they had in common, besides being a compulsive overeater, is that they had a really strong relationship with a higher power. And I couldn't deny it anymore. I wasn't really getting anywhere. I couldn't maintain any kind of abstinence. And I thought, okay, I'm going to act as if I believe in a higher power. I heard all these things at meetings, act as if this, act as if that. So I pretended I believed in God. And one day, it was a Sunday afternoon, I remember, and I was reading the big book, and I was putting it back on my night table, and it's so funny, when this first happened, and the first few years after this happened, I couldn't talk about it. I felt a little ashamed that I actually had, like, this experience that I heard a voice, you know. And the voice said, "You are not alone, and you never have been." And I thought, wow, that must be my higher power. I wasn't talking. There was nobody else in the room. That must be mine. And I was very excited. I was very excited and very embarrassed that I now believed in a higher power. And I still didn't get abstinent. What happened was, I think, this is all in hindsight, that I had to develop that God muscle, you know. I really didn't know what to do with it. You know, people said in step three, you turn your life over to higher power. I had no idea what that meant. But I kept books by my bed, you know, little meditation books. I read that every morning. I read the big book. I read the 12 and 12. I really threw myself into the program. To this day, I can't tell you why I did, except I had no place else to go. And I had tried, you know, everything that you've tried, I tried. So, but I started working the steps with my sponsor. And the first step, I only read the first part of the first step, you know, that I'm powerless over food. I knew that before I came in. But that after that little dash and my life is unmanageable, I didn't think my life was unmanageable. I thought I had a really good life. I had a lot of friends. And I just really thought everything was okay. I came to realize many years later that underneath that everything okay was massive hysteria. I was such an anxious person. And kind of like what Randy was saying, I was waiting to hear from you what was okay in this world. I had no opinions because when I was younger, it was too dangerous to have strong opinions. So I waited. I waited to hear what was going on, what the party line was, and I followed that. Step two, I was pretty insulted by, you know, this thing that I'm being restored to sanity, implying that there's some insanity in my life. Very insulted by that. And it didn't occur to me until many years later when I heard, here is my insanity as a compulsive overeater. I'll start tomorrow. I'll only have just one. I'm going to eat all of the blank today because I'm never going to have them again. That's my insanity as a compulsive overeater. Doesn't mean I had to be carted away. That was my insanity that I lived by. But I was willing now to have this higher power. So step three came, and now I'm trying to figure out how to do this. How do I actually turn my will and my life over to this higher power? What do I do? And I was baffled. I really, really didn't know. One day, I was reading the newspaper, and I saw Peanuts. I never read Peanuts. I never read it before, and I never read it since this day. But this day, I read Peanuts, and it said, Charlie Brown was reading a book, and Lucy's in a swing. And Charlie said, "Do you know that it takes 365 days for the Earth to revolve around the sun?" Lucy says, "Really? Yep. You sure about that? Thank you." He said, "I'm sure, it's right here." And the last frame is Lucy, and she says, "That's funny because I thought the world revolved around me." And I looked at that. You've heard that a million times, haven't you, Joe? I looked at that, and I thought, Lucy too? And I pictured this globe spinning on my head. And I just gave it to my higher power. And I took step three. and I was able to become abstinent. And since that time, basically what my program is about is developing that relationship and really trying to not lose sight of that relationship when I feel nervous, anxious, frightened, to not lose sight of it. So I still have the books by my bed. Now some of them are on Kindle, and it saves a lot of space. And that's what I do in the mornings. Step four, I just want to talk about that. This inventory thing, I thought, well, I haven't really done anything wrong, so I'm not going to need to take this inventory. You know, everything that I heard the first time, I thought, nah, that's not me. Everything I heard. But I stayed. I stayed because, as I said, people here seemed unfettered by food. And I wanted that more than I wanted anything else. That's all. From when I was 4 years old and obsessed to when I was 37, 33 years of starting tomorrow. It kind of shocked me when I realized that. 33 years of starting tomorrow. They add up, don't they, those years? So that's really what I've done. I've stayed involved with the program. I have always done service. I actually ran this birthday party, as a chairman of this birthday party. I don't know what year it is this year, but when I was the chair of the party, our slogan was Happy, Joyous, and 33. So whenever that was, whatever year it is now, that's the year that I did that. And did work on the board and always had meeting commitments. 6 years ago, I should say 10 years ago, my life changed. I began a relationship with a woman, which, believe me, that was never in my cards at all. And it was as big a shock to me as it was to the people I told. I remember people going like that when I told them. But it's a lovely relationship. She's in the program too, and that's really nice. And together we have a 6-year-old son, 59, and I get a kid. You just never know what's coming around the corner. You just never know when people say, my life is horrible, my life is a mess, and I can so easily say, look at my life. You just don't know what's coming around the corner. I love Overeaters Anonymous. Everything that I've gotten in my life, the way I behave today is not the way I behaved 29 years ago. The first time I was with a friend of mine who I'd known since we were 13, and she asked me a question, and I said I didn't know the answer. And she said, you don't know the answer to something? And 'cause I did. I did until 29 years ago. I remember Dara Siegel, who was an old-timer. She died in the program. She was like 96 or something. And she talked about her character defects, and she said, I have 37 character defects. And the biggest thing I've learned is that when somebody is talking to me and offering their opinion about something that I don't really want to hear, I say to them, you might be right. They might be right. They might. And it kind of also disarms them from saying anything else. They kind of feel good that they were heard. And that has served me so well in my life. You might be right. Sometimes they are, you know. I learned that when I was, I'm retired now, but when I was working and somebody asked me to do something, and I would say, I'd be happy to. Now, people would know at one particular job, I hated my job. I just hated it. But I'd be happy to. I had a job. Thank you. And so those are like some of the little things that I've learned here. They should have a book. Everything I know about life I learned in OA. And maybe one day I'll write it. So thank you very much.
I just don't want to knock anything off. Okay. Hi, my name is Karen. I'm a compulsive overeater. And louder. Oh, okay. Thank you. I walked into my first Overeaters Anonymous meeting sometime in the fall of 1975. I was 20 years old, and I had been on a diet at that point probably for every day since I was 8 years old. So the 12 years before that included diet doctors, diet shots, diet camps, diet books. I grew up in a household where my mother's mother was obese, and my mother was terrified that any of her children would wind up like that. And so there was this underlying obsession of thin, not for any other reason other than you shouldn't look like grandma. Problem is that in my life, my grandmother was the one who provided unconditional love. And so I grew up knowing that I was fat and not knowing that there was any way to deal with it, because nothing ever worked in the long run. And my senior year, my sophomore year in college, my mother called me up and asked me if I wanted to spend the summer at Duke University. And so she sent me down to the Dietary Rehabilitation Clinic. And a year later, when I came home, because I basically talked them into letting me stay for the entire scholastic year, I had lost a grand total of 3 pounds. Because what had happened was that I lost about 70 and then gained back 67 while I was living down there. And I came home, and my parents decided that for some reason I was not to be trusted, and so the idea of sending me away to school wasn't going to work for them. So I had to apply to every school in New York City so that they could keep their eye on me from their house in Brooklyn. And I got into NYU, and I started classes. And between classes, I would do things like, you're in college, right? Supposed to go to the library? I would walk up and down East 8th Street going from luncheonette to luncheonette and from food store to food store. And on any given day, I was eating the same thing in two or three different places because I was telling myself that I was taste testing. And that when I found the best one, then I could only eat one. But until I knew which one was the best, I was going to, so there was the chicken salad sandwich day. And there was the grilled cheese sandwich. I mean, so it just went on. And when I wasn't doing that, I would walk through grocery stores to find the things that were new and exciting. Because, those were the interesting things. I always wound up eating the same thing. But that's what I would go, cruising in the aisles of the grocery store. And I was coming out of Gristides on University Place. There was this big oak tag sign, which tells you how old I am, because I remember oak tag and magic markers. And it said on the top of the sign, "Do you have a problem with food?" And I can remember, as if it was yesterday, I can tell you that my response was, "I don't have a problem with food. I have a problem with my weight." But at the bottom it said, "Free, free, free, no dues, no fees, free, free, free." And there was a meeting that was going to be held at the student union at NYU the following Monday or Tuesday. And so I figured that free was about as much as I was going to get my parents to spend after we had spent all this money at Duke University for me to lose 3 pounds. So I went to this meeting. And I've gone to a lot of meetings where people say, they walked in and they immediately felt as if they were home. I did not. My first meeting, the qualifier talked about how, as far as I can remember, she was restored to sanity by Jesus Christ. And, they didn't talk about him in synagogue, so I wasn't quite sure that this was... And then the next thing was that they sent around this book and they wanted you to put your name and your telephone number in it. And, I'm in New York City now. My mother told me not to talk to strangers, let alone give you my telephone number. And this group of people was about as strange as a group of people was. And I just didn't know what was going on. So I just kind of passed the book on. And then the next thing they did at this free meeting is that they passed a basket. And I had a dollar in my pocket and a token in my, in one coat pocket, my great big brown coat that, you know, I wore well into seasons that it was not appropriate for. But a token in one pocket, a dollar in the other pocket, and you shouldn't think I was cheap, so I put the dollar in the basket, and feeling like I was in church, because that, you know, we don't do that in synagogue. We do it once a year with little envelopes. And at the end of the meeting, they were selling literature in the back of the room, and I no longer had any money, so I stole a gray sheet and I left. The bottom line is, the only thing that was interesting on that table, there were big books, there were AA 12 and 12s, there was the two or three pieces of literature that existed in 1975, and there was a gray sheet. You know, with all I knew, the only thing I was here for was to lose weight, so the only thing that was interesting on that table was the food plan. So I took the food plan, and I went home, and I sat on the train, and I read it, and I realized that there was no way on God's green earth that I could follow this food plan. I mean, there was no bread, rice, and potatoes. I mean, forget it. It was unhealthy. You know, what I was eating to get me at that point to about 220 pounds was really healthy. But, you know, gray sheet wasn't going to do it. And I walked into the house, and my mother asked me what had happened. And as I tromped up the stairs, I yelled behind me, "It was really stupid. They're all praying to get thin." And behind me, my mother said, "You know, I have a friend who goes to AA." She had a friend who was 20 years sober in AA at that point, but I didn't know that. She says all of those meetings, you know, that each meeting has their own personality. Maybe you should go to another meeting. It's the only time I listened to my mother. It's the only time my mother said anything really nice about Overeaters Anonymous. But I came back because my mother suggested it. And I will tell you that that was 1975. In 1986, I had a conversation with the man who became my sponsor for about 20 years. And his response when I told him this story was, "My God, you got it on the first night." I may have heard it on the first night. I did not get it on the first night. It took me from 1975 until 1979 to even consider starting any kind of abstinence. I proceeded to, at one point, drop out of school, tell my parents I had graduated, and moved back to Durham, North Carolina, because I had realized at that point that I could live in Durham at that point about 280 pounds and not be the biggest one in the room. And that, for me, was really important. It didn't matter. I mean, I was going to be fat. I mean, I had made career decisions. I was a music major. I was a voice major. Not because I wanted to necessarily sing opera, because what I really wanted to do was be Barbara Streisand, but I wouldn't tell anybody that. But I went to the opera with my father when I was a kid, and I saw those 300-pound women in the costumes with the dark panels that made them supposedly, you know, this 300-pound woman look like a Spanish cigarette girl, you know, and said, "Oh, I can be successful and fat." It was the only thing I knew that you could do, and have both of those things be part of the description of you as a person. So I became a voice major, thinking I was going to become an opera singer. They made me an education major, and so I did the next best thing. I became a philosophy major. I don't know why, except for the fact that I enjoyed it. And I spent that time between the time I went to my first meeting and when I went to North Carolina going to meetings because my mother told me to come back, and doing things like I figured out very quickly that you said the same thing at the beginning of every meeting, so I didn't have to show up for the first 10 minutes because, you know, I had heard those steps and traditions, and it was like, you know, and tools, and who you know, I'm smart. I know what you were saying, so I would show up 10, 15 minutes late, and I would listen to the qualifier because at that point most of the meetings that I was going to in New York had people qualifying, and I would listen for 20 minutes, and it was very interesting. And I heard keep coming back, and I also heard that it, you know, we don't care what you eat, we love you anyway, you know, just keep coming back. So I kept coming back, and nobody was going to care about what I ate, so it was okay. And after the person would speak, I would leave the meeting because I figured if you had anything really important to say, then eventually you would be qualifying and I would hear you then. So somebody once described it a number of years after that is I was an OA tourist for the first year and a half. I wasn't a member, but I was coming to meetings. And, I learned the lingo really fast because my mother would ask me why I was going to these meetings and I go, well, you know, it's not about the food. And thin isn't well. I mean, those were the two things that I held on to for years. And I went to North Carolina. That didn't work. Long story. I wound up in Ohio. And I had gotten one very fast story from North Carolina. What got me abstinent was I was arrested for bouncing a check to a Kroger's. And it was 1979, 1980. They had just... You know, there were no ATM machines. You know, if you wanted money, people had to wire it to you. And they arrested me at 4:30 in the afternoon by the time I was processed. It was 5:30. Everything was closed. I called my mother's first cousin because I wasn't going to call my mother to tell her that I was in jail. I mean, you know, my dad was a doctor. My mom went to Vassar. This was not what they had intended for me to be doing. And... my cousin was married to a lawyer, and he took care of it, and they sent money. But I, you know, this is North Carolina. They don't give you a ticket, which is what they do in New York. I mean, you know, you bounced a check, you know, you just have to pay it back. They put you in jail. And so I was in a cell overnight with the three black hookers next to me, and on the other side, the girl who had gotten mad at her boyfriend took out a shotgun and shot up the car. And then, you know, so what are you in for? You know, I felt like Arlo Guthrie at, you know, sitting in the Group W bench. For those of you who are old enough to remember, you know, what did you do? And he said, literally, you know, what did you do? I bounced a $10 check to Kroger's because I needed to buy my, you know, whatever I was buying at 3 o'clock in the morning. It didn't matter whether there was money in the bank. And so I wound up at a retreat. I got abstinent at that retreat because I was finally scared enough that I knew that I needed to do something. And my sponsor and I decided how much I weighed because we couldn't find a scale that would weigh me. And so I will tell you that as far as I know, my top weight was 350 pounds. You know, whether it was 348 or 352, I don't know. But that's the number that we've come to. And I eventually wound up moving to Cincinnati because, you know, nothing's as good as a geographic cure. Wound up in Cincinnati, and I went from 350 to about 280 and sat there because my idea of abstinence was it was three meals a day with nothing in between. The problem was is that I didn't define what those meals were. And we went to a workshop in Lafayette, Indiana, and I met this person who was leading the workshop, who eventually, after a number of go-arounds, wound up sponsoring me in the How concept. And he was the co-founder of How, and, you know, he was, you know, but it was those days when How meant gray sheet. When you went out to restaurants, you ate half of what it was. We did not weigh and measure without exception. We weighed and measured in our house, so that's how I learned, you know, what to do. Basically, as we went through this process, you know, that first question of the, God, it's 40 years and I'm still only at 1980. This isn't good and I've got 5 minutes left. But when we went through my food diary, we realized that he had been my Weight Watcher lecturer when I was 12 years old. So I had a rather long relationship with Fred. And he was my sponsor off and on until he died. And that was about 12 years ago. In that time, I had periods of long-term abstinence. I had periods of long-term relapse. I also had periods of what I still called abstinence and gained weight. That last period ended about 9 years ago. I had gained a lot of weight again, and it was time to do something. And, you know, it has, the weight's reduced since then. I did a surgical procedure to help. But I knew, even in doing that, that that was a tool. It was not the answer. It put an immediate stop to certain things that were going on, and it was necessary at that point. That being said, I walked, just to give you the overview and arc of my life, I walked into program at the age of 20. I had never had a date. I had never had a long-term relationship with anyone other than my family. And I got to make all of my mistakes in Overeaters Anonymous. And I've had made all of the really good decisions in my life in Overeaters Anonymous because I learned from my mistakes. And in OA, you allow me to do that. So that this kid who never had a date has been married twice. My first husband I met in program. I met him because my sponsor told me to go hug him at a World Service Convention in Seattle, Washington. And we became best friends, and he eventually moved to New York, and we did get married, but he also had colon cancer at the time, and he passed away about a year after that. And 10 days after he died, I got on an airplane, and I came to the birthday party because I knew that I needed something other than, I mean, because he died in my home, you know, in my apartment in Brooklyn. And so I needed something else, and I came here. And it was the last time I was at the birthday party, and but it was a wonderful experience. And so when a friend of mine was speaking this weekend, you know, my husband, my now husband and I decided that this would be a good thing to do, and that's why we're here this weekend. In the time that I've been in program, the one thing, I heard it yesterday again, and it really struck me, and I'm going to leave you with this because I've actually, I thought I was going to get through my old times, you know, really fast and get to the meat, but I didn't. And that is that what the big book tells me is that I'm a compulsive overeater, that no one can relieve my compulsion, and that God could and would, if he were sought, not found, if he were sought. So for me, you know, I'm really jealous of people who get specific answers. My answers are more experiential, and I just keep questioning and looking. The difference between me today and me then was, I won't tell you that there isn't. What I say is, I don't know. And, you know, my first husband used to talk about the fact that there's a higher power, and the only thing he knows about that higher power is that it wasn't him. You know, and so as long as I'm relying on a power outside of myself, and for me, most of the time, it is Overeaters Anonymous, you know, I will, you know, be successful. I will tell you that for the first time today, I have, because he's going to tell me that I didn't say this if I don't do this. So I apologize for going a second over. I was in the elevator on my way down this morning. And this man and woman got in, and they saw, you know, we both had name tags on and wanted to know what this convention was. And so I told her. And she went, oh, well, you don't look like you ever needed it. And I went, you know, looks can be deceiving. And so I'm just really grateful to be here, and thank you for allowing me to share.
Now it is time for questions and answers. Please raise your hand, and I will call on as many questioners as possible. Your questions can be directed at one person specifically or generally for the panel to answer. Please be aware that we are recording this panel, and when asking a question, your voice may be audible on the recording. Who would like to ask the first question? Sherry. I have experience with that, and we'll ask them. I just keep doing what I'm doing. I still would get up in the morning, read the books, do the writing, and just go through it, and just keep hoping it would come back, and eventually did. I went through a period, it must have been about a year, that I didn't really feel anything. I just kept doing it. I didn't know what else to do. Anybody else want to?
I have, I cycle. I have times when I feel, you know, very connected to things around me. There are times when I just feel, I'm the only one. Why, why doesn't everybody have to do it this way? Poor me. It's me against the world. And the one thing that I've done more recently is that I have a core group of people who have been in as long as I have or longer. And I utilize them as, that's when, I may not call them every day. Some of them I talk to more regularly than others. But when I'm feeling that way, those are the people who I need to reach out to. And I keep a core group of those types of folks who I can call and say, you know, how do you get through this? And in many cases, they've been through, you know, similar situations, and they can help coach me through that, and that really helps.
I also find at that time is when I really start concentrating on the tools. And invariably, I know that it's going to pass. So I'll get into writing, I'll get into meetings, I'll get into phone calls. And quite frankly, it doesn't really matter what tool it is. Just the fact that I'm taking some kind of action. And if one tool doesn't work, I'll go to the next one, the next one, the next one. And eventually, it does pass.
Anybody else?
Great question, Judy. When I came in to Overeaters Anonymous, there was a lot more structure to it. The food plan was more structured. The meetings were more structured. And I think on the negative side, We've kind of lost that to a certain extent, and this is just my opinion. And that's why I'm going back to my real focus on self-discipline this year. But what I did see at this birthday party that has energized me is the number of young people. I haven't seen this many young people taking on areas of responsibility in years, and I'm really energized about that. And I hope that we will continue to attract people, and particularly young people, who in 40 years, they could be here.
What I see, and it worries me, is that the idea of abstinence has gotten watered down. And I hear people say, well, my sponsor says as long as I keep coming back, that's my abstinence. And I think this is not, keep coming back anonymous. This is Overeaters Anonymous. And I heard somebody at a meeting say recently, it's not my responsibility what I put in my mouth. And I got to tell you, I'm worried about this. I'm very worried about it. This program is my life. It saved my life. And my abstinence, like I said before, is black and white. I know when I am and I know when I'm not. It's about the food. Until it's not about the food, as we know. But you come in here, it's about the food. And we have to put it down. And what I see is more people not willing to put it down. And it really, I can't tell you how it really saddens me and worries me about our fellowship. I guess I have to start praying for that. Thank you.
Okay. If I offend you, I apologize. I am a recovering compulsive overeater. I am not recovered. And if you want to know what I see that scares the living daylights out of me, that's what I'm seeing, is that there is this idea that by reading a single text, that holds every answer for every compulsive overeater, and that is the answer. It may be an answer for you. The one thing I've learned in this, in the 40 years is that just because it doesn't work for me doesn't mean that it's not right for you. And I've got no problem with that. But on the East Coast, at least, because I'm still, I live in Baltimore, in the Baltimore or Maryland area right now. I go to meetings, and there are times when I feel as if what I'm doing, having lost 200 and some odd pounds, is not good enough because I still think it's a recovery process. And I'm not sure that the people who are doing those meetings, who talk about that, who started this, actually mean what people are hearing. But I know for me, we have a large group of people who think that they're working the steps, who don't think that they need to put the food down because the food isn't their responsibility. There are a lot of them who are. I have a girl in my home meeting who's lost 105 pounds, and she eats, she claims she doesn't have a plan of eating. I don't know how she did it, but she's not my sponsor, and I don't talk to her about it, but what she's doing is working. Yay. But I think that we need to get back to the fact that this is Overeaters Anonymous. And it's not AA Lite, and it's not AA for people who have a weight problem. It's Overeaters Anonymous, and we have, something to offer, that is in... That's worked for a long time, and I think the retweaking and people wanting to retool is not necessarily always healthy.
We have time for one more question, so why don't you? What do we say to newcomers?
What do we say to newcomers when we go up to them after their first meeting? I just introduce myself and give my experience strength and hope. When I came in, I wanted to hear about the weight loss. Hi, I'm Randy. I am a compulsive overeater. I have been maintaining a 50, 60-pound weight loss for 33 years. And then the next thing that they usually ask is, well, how did you do it? And when I tell them, they usually walk away because they're looking for an easier, softer way. That's unfortunately That's unfortunate. Sometimes I think I come on a little bit too strong, but I have a serious disease, and this is a life and death program for me.
What I usually say is what I felt at my first meeting was some of it, and I tell them that my head was spinning after my first meeting. What were they talking about? And just be patient, because this is something that really works. I don't spend a lot of time doing a lot of other stuff, and just encourage them to keep going to more meetings and giving it a chance.
One of the things is that I don't have to tell them how much weight I've lost, because in most of our meetings we qualify, do that. I've been absent for X amount of time, I've lost X amount of weight at the beginning of whatever we say, so the newcomers know who they're coming to. But for me, because I had to put the food down before I could work the steps, I'll talk to them about, what I had to do, and then, leave the rest of it, because, my sponsor dragged me through the steps. He told me all I had to do was step one on day one. He said, don't worry about those other ones, and then he went through and kept telling me that if I didn't do the next one, I was going to eat, so he scared me to get through the steps. But that notwithstanding, I don't hand them, and you have to turn your will and your life over to God and blah, blah, blah. It's very simple. I stopped eating compulsively, and I used, the things that I learned in the program to help me continue stop eating compulsively.
Did you have a burning question? Can you repeat that? I just know that I live in L.A., and I know that in L.A. and in the Valley, there's a committee called 12 Step Within, so that I know that that's what they do. They're working on that kind of thing, having workshops and things like that. So that's all I know about that.
That's kind of a loaded question, because I currently live in Tucson, Arizona, and the meetings are very, very different. And that's been a challenge for me, because there seems to be much less of an emphasis on abstinence. And that's why I keep in very close touch with my peeps in L.A. All I can do is to keep being an example of the people in the rooms. And if I keep speaking my truth, I may not save the world, but maybe I can just be an example for one person. So for me, the best thing that I can do is to maintain my abstinence, to maintain a relatively normal body weight, and to practice the steps and traditions of this program.
Just really quickly, just because the minute you asked that, I flashed on the face of a friend of mine who passed away this year, who was the person who And I can remember at the World Service Business Conference back in the 80s when she stood up at the microphone and she said, "Why are we like as if we are at an Olympic event and saying, 'I'm going to go for the bronze'?" That's how the 12-Step Within Committee got started. And it's very important. And I think, if it's not going on in your area, you need to talk to your intergroup and find out what types of things are available in order to help you, because there is this big movement right now amongst us where, you know, they've taken that whole idea that it's not about the food to an extent that really scares the living daylights out of me. Because for me, again, it's not about the food. It is about the food until it's not about the food. But until you get that food dealt with, it's about the food.
Thank you. Thank you to our timer and to you all for participating in this panel discussion. After the serenity prayer, would everyone please clear the room, as depending upon the timing, there might be another panel, although I don't think there is. I think that's all, folks. So thank you for allowing us to be of service. Let's say the serenity prayer.
Thank you.